So we're making better decisions, and the fruit quality should even be better on this next go around.
In the present, I need to evolve, I need to change lots of things.
Okay, I think a few times they ask me, Giovanni, do you have fun in what you're doing?
Well, you reinvent yourself, right? I think that's really where that begins and ends.
I think 18's legendary. It's going to go down in history.
I haven't made the same wine twice, have no intention of duplicating anything.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 354. This week, we feature Matt Michael of Baldessari Family Winery in Sonoma.
This podcast is sponsored by Release Winery. Every wine tells a story. Each growing season, it's our goal to create an artisan Napa Valley wine of exceptional quality. Join us as the story of this ultra-limited wine continues. Learn more at releasewinery.com.
We love small wineries. It's no secret. The smaller, the better. And the better chance a visitor gets to meet the winemaker. Baldessari Family Winery has a tasting room in the sweet little downtown of Windsor in Sonoma County. If you visit there, likely you'll meet the owner and winemaker, Matt Michael, and we'll let Matt explain the name difference. It may be small, but the wine is mighty. You can hear Matt on our Vino Lingo segment defining the term élevage. I'm here with Matt Michael, and Matt is the winemaker at Baldessari Winery. And we're here in downtown Windsor, which is really just charming as heck. What a cute little place.
It is. It is. It's very charming. One of the reasons why we liked it and why we picked the spot was because we're what we call a custom crush facility. So I am a winemaker by day job. This is also my brand, Baldessari. And so we actually make our wine at another winery through custom crush. And then we have the ability to open a tasting room wherever we want. Just turns out in Sonoma County, real estate in the vineyard country and wine country is very expensive. So an urban tasting room seemed like it penciled out a lot better.
So you own the brand then?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So it's going to be kind of interesting, you know, to work for another winery. A lot of winemakers make their own wine on the side, but rarely do they have a tasting room, especially a nice one like this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's been a culminate. We've been doing it for 15 years. It's my father and myself.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. So, and we started out very small with 90 cases, 2003. And just kind of trucked along. We figured if we made a mistake, and we were going to make a small mistake, you know, we didn't want to get over our skis and start overproducing and then not have a home for it. It turns out it's very easy to make wine. It's actually quite tough to sell it. And so that's kind of the key is get some sales and channels in place.
Yeah.
And then start producing as your sales channels grow, as opposed to the other way where you produce a bunch of wine and then you're looking for a home to put it.
How many cases are you doing now?
It depends on the vintage, between 1,000 and 1,200.
Well, that's still a reasonable size for a small winery.
It is, yeah. And so we had started, we got our toes wet with a tasting room. We did a co-op tasting room in downtown Guerneville. And with another brand, it just so happened the space was very small. And it just, we, you know, kind of immediately outgrew the space. So we decided to pull out, and it gave us enough confidence to open this space here and kind of take it for ourselves. So.
And when did you open here again?
January 16th of 2019. So we've been open about 6 months now.
Yeah. You got it right down to the day.
To the day, yeah. That was a very, very big moment for us and our brand.
Oh, yeah, I'll bet. This is a big investment.
It is a big investment.
The $64,000 question is, how's it going?
So far, so good.
Great.
We figured if we could break even the first year, that would be a fantastic goal. It's my father and I. We do everything, including marketing. So we're doing a little better than that, so that's good. Yeah.
Well, this is the kind of thing we like. You know, love talking to winemakers who are small makers who are, you know, I'm not saying struggling, but fighting to get out there, because let's face it, if you want to get into a retail or anything like that, or distribution, ending up on a shelf is a bit of a challenge, isn't it?
It's huge. It's getting more and more challenging.
It's crowded.
It's crowded, and what you're seeing is a real consolidation of the industry. So a lot of the big guys that you hear that are, oh, this person bought this winery, that person bought that winery, it also affects the distribution network, because as these wineries start to own more and more and more properties, they own more and more of the distribution channel too, which that means is they control more and more of the shelf space that supermarkets have and fine wine retailers have. They just have more leverage in there. So it's brands like us, small brands, it's very challenging to get anyone's attention unless you go to restaurants still seem to really care about small producers and high-end bottle shops and high-end grocers that really want to curtail to that kind of different wine audience, I think. But those are small and there's a lot of competition there. So, it is hard. It's very challenging to go the wholesale route with a brand.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. It's a difficult thing. So are you primarily direct customer then, or?
Mostly. We still have accounts that we've developed over the last 15 years that have been very good to us and we have a good relationship. And so we still very much are involved with those accounts and we won't hesitate to develop a new account. When we were starting up, we just took anything we could get because we wanted to get our foot in the door. Right. Now it has to kind of make sense. We're not as willing to take ultra low margins just to get a deal closed because sometimes it doesn't make sense for us. In the beginning, that very much wasn't the case.
I get that.
Yeah.
Well, startup is startup, isn't
it? Yeah, yeah.
So your full-time job is your winemaker at Robert Young, correct?
Correct,
which is a good-sized winery.
Yeah.
Do you crush there or do you crush elsewhere?
I crush elsewhere, yeah. I think there's, I personally didn't want to mingle those two things together.
Sure. Yeah.
I feel like, there's always a question of where your loyalty leads when you have your own brand under the brand that you work for. And so I just felt like even if they would have offered it to me, I wouldn't have done it because it just creates a situation that I didn't want to be involved in.
Sure. Yeah. No, that's fair because it kind of keeps you on straight and narrow, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm there. They can see me. I'm not doing anything on my wine, there's no questions raised there.
So you said this was something you and your dad started. So first thing is, your last name is Michael.
Yeah.
And the wine is not called that.
Yes.
So how did that work out?
So it's really a tribute to my maternal grandfather. His name was Vincenzo Baldessari, and he emigrated from the Marche region of Italy, which is in the Adriatic. He came when he was 17. The little house that we have on our label was a handwritten sketch he had of his house because he knew he'd never be back. In those days, if you took the trip to America to find a better life, chances are you weren't coming back. And so that's how the house made it onto our label. He was the first one to introduce me to wine. He lived in Chicago, where my mom's from, and every year we'd go out to visit. And as a lot of people from the old world did, he had a deep basement, and he would make his charcuteries, his salamis and everything, and keep them down there. And he also would have a quarter or half barrel of wine, depending on the year. And so he would cut me some of his salamis and pour me a little small cup of wine. And then we would, this started when I was 8 years old.
Yeah.
And so it just got me entrenched with the idea of the family winemaker and the family kind of artisan producer. And so when we launched this label, it just seemed fitting to go full circle with it. It's the kind of the keeping not only the name alive, but keeping the tradition alive,
sure.
Being the family winemaker. Well, it turns out 1,000 cases is too much to drink for a family. But
oh, really? Yeah. I have no problem with that at all. Which could lead to serious problems.
Yeah, right.
So for you, did you grow up around wine otherwise? I mean, to lead to the road to actually saying, I'm going to do this for a living.
Yeah.
How did that work out?
It was a very circuitous route. I don't think that what happened with my grandfather inspired me to actually take that leap, but I had always been interested in wine and winemaking and for that matter, alcohol production I thought was very fascinating. It was really when I was transferring to UC Davis and I had to declare a major as a transfer student and they gave me a catalog and they said, you don't have to stick with this, but you have to pick a major to declare. And so I flipped through the catalog and I came across this beautiful major called fermentation science. And it had beer making and hard alcohol distillation, pharmaceutical production, but also winemaking, viticulture and enology. I said, that seems, if I bet out of those things, something there is going to work for me. I was never quite the type that could sit there for hours and read books and noodle things out in a piece of paper. I was very mechanically inclined. I like to work with stuff and I like to be moving around. And so I did some research into those fields, and I realized that a lot of it is, you know, there is always, of course, some clerical work, but a lot of it's, you know, things that keep you on your feet and moving around.
Sure, yeah. Just like any other business.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So what do you like to drink? Oh, gosh, one of you would ask that question before.
So that's funny. I go through a lot of cycles. Right now, I am completely off the big, bold red cycle. I'm into Italian varietals, Nebbiolo, Barbera. Nebbiolo in particular is very fascinating to me right now. Domestically, Pinot, Grenache. I'm into exotic whites, Vermentino, Albarino, Malone. These just, you know. But it's something that I have this somewhat addictive personality when it comes to varietals, that I'll get into one and then I'll just buy as many as I can. Sure. And then I'll get burnt out and go to another one. And so that's kind of, ask me next month and I'll be onto something else. So
yeah. That's not unusual for people who love wine though, really.
I think so, yeah. You get into it and it becomes this learning thing, and I'm sort of a geek in that way, as I'll do a lot of reading about it just to see where they come from. And I'm not someone who was raised in a wine circle or raised with that acumen, so a lot of it's self-learned and self. I just read and learn about it because it interests me.
Sure.
And then I like to see the different styles within the varietal that people make, both internationally and here domestically, and just kind of see what the differences are. And it's just good fun, yeah, for me. Yeah.
What are you making here?
So we make a Sonoma Coast Chardonnay. We make a Rosé of Pinot Noir, which comes from our Pinot Noir, Russian River Pinot Noir. And then we make a Syrah from Bennett Valley. And then we also, we haven't released it yet, but we're going to do a Malbec from Asti, which is up in Northern Alexander Valley.
Really?
So all Sonoma County, we're Sonoma County brand.
Sure, yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Do you own any vineyards at this point or no?
No, we don't.
Do you think you will somewhere down
Probably
the road?
Probably not. Yeah. It's just, there's a number, land in Sonoma County as the rest of California is becoming increasingly expensive, but you know, there's a big struggle in both Sonoma and Napa. You know, turns out that people also like to live where vineyards grow. Mm-hmm. So that land is becoming increasingly expensive. And it's just with the labor and the way labor is going right now in agriculture, you can almost add, you know, a certain percentage of increased expense every year for vineyard farming. So it's a very difficult thing to I'll just put it this way, the prices on the shelf for bottles are not rising according with the costs of everything else, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Well, I think that's a challenge. People do complain about how much wine in California has gone up in terms of price, but of course nobody wants to look to where that comes from.
Yeah.
You as a winemaker know that your hands are purple. If you barrel ferment or if you do anything special, and simply getting the crop in on time.
Yeah.
You know, it's a big thing. I'm assuming since you're leasing or you're getting fruit from other places, that part of your labor isn't really your concern because it's the owner's issue, or no?
It's not directly my concern, but it reflects in price per ton grape increase.
Sure.
So, you know, I've seen in the last few years the prices just tick up every year. It's mainly to do with the labor costs. You know, everyone needs to make money in this. It can't be certain people that are making money. It has to work for everyone. So that's kind of what you're seeing. There was, for a long time, there was labor suppression, price suppression, because there was unlimited labor, essentially. Now there's not, and you know, people are making what they should have been making a long time ago. So.
Sure. Yeah, that's a big deal. What do you see as the labor issues? Is it the immigration thing? Is it younger people not really wanting to go out there and work? How do you see that?
I think it's all of the above. I mean, I know that you know, the border is not as easy to get through, and it really affects the ag industry, because a lot of what, you know, people forget that, I don't know what it is, 60 or 65% of the produce in America comes from California. And so we have a huge migrant labor force that goes back and forth across the border to do that. And when the borders, you know, essentially close down or it's not as permeable, these people get through, it creates a lot of difficulties internally in the state to find labor to, you know, get those jobs completed. So, and it's just, you know, I think as there's other industries that have cropped up, marijuana being one, that just pay more money. And so all of these things divide the labor force.
That makes it tough. I have an idea. Parachutes, what do you think? Parachutes, right?
Yeah.
How to be jumpers.
Yeah,
that's that'll right. be perfect.
Right.
I'm almost funny. Nobody's really thought about that. Really, when you think about it, it's like, I don't know, is it worth the difference between, you know, going to the border? Okay, I'm being an idiot. I come up with stupid things from time to time. How long have you been a winemaker for?
My first vintage was 2000. So I did a Southern Hemisphere vintage, so I'll be going into my 20th vintage now.
Nice. Congratulations.
Thanks. It's not as quite as fun as it used to be, and I don't say that in a weird way. It's just vintage is this ever-consuming thing that requires long hours and weekends, and I haven't had a Labor Day weekend in 20 years. Yeah, I love college football, and I rarely get to watch a game. So those things after 20 years start to compound in your mind a little bit. But
oh, man, that's the romance.
That's right.
It's also the romance of owning a business.
It is, yeah.
People don't understand that.
Yeah, it's very romantic.
And it's not their problem.
It's not, yeah, right. Yeah. And that's it's part of the gig, and I realize that. And I always have. It's, you know, it's more of a longing for some of those things that I used to remember fondly.
Yeah. You like time off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
in general, it's kind of amazing. Yeah. I think you have to be just about dead before that happens.
Right, yeah. I'm starting to see that.
Yeah. So, for the period of time we've been doing this, we started a new question that's been an exciting and fun question, and winemakers just kind of look at me blank when I ask it. So I'll throw it at you.
Okay.
I'm sure you've done plenty of interviews and talked to media over the years.
Yeah.
What's one question that you don't get asked that you would like to be asked?
That is a very tough question on the spot. I think people never ask really what makes a good, inexpensive wine expensive, like what's behind this small label, and why are the costs so much. I think it's a very consumer, the industry somewhat is a consumer driven industry, where any other facet, you can go to Costco, or you can, to a certain extent with wine, but you can go to these places and you're just shopping for the lowest price. And if it's the equal item, like if it's, you get Heineken beer at Payless for $20 an 18 pack or whatever, and you get it at Costco for 14, that's the one you grab. But okay. With these small brands that don't have representation out there in general, there's much more going on dynamically with the product, that and the costs are much, much more suppressed in a very finite area. And so what you're really getting is a much different product that should be very unique, and that's kind of why the cost is elevated on some of this stuff. It's not a commodity driven product, if that makes sense. It's a very, you know, you're looking at things, for instance, our Sonoma Coast Chardonnay is 170 cases. It's from excellent fruit, and we do a lot of things in the winery to preserve the fruit that we buy, and that won't happen on a truckload of 80 tons that's fermented in a giant tank. And it's just a different economy of scale. And so I think that conversation would be good to have about why, you know, these smaller wineries and these smaller brands, why the prices are so high, and what we're trying to deliver that maybe you're not getting at a $15 or $12 bottle of wine.
Well, it's also intimate. A small winery is intimate. It's not the same experience you're going to get when you go to a larger place.
Exactly.
But you bring up an interesting point that I never really considered when you talk about beer, and people don't realize what goes into making a bottle of wine, and they think, beer is so much more, it's never really gone up.
Yeah, yeah.
And wine has.
That was one of the reasons why I picked wine, was because if you go to any brewery, I'm a huge beer connoisseur. I love beer. Right. Yeah. Yeah. It takes a lot of beer to make wine. Yeah. That's what they say. Right. But, if you go to breweries, it's essentially, most of them are brewing 24 hours a day. It is almost a commodity driven thing, where you're trying to fill the pipelines with the same similar flavor over and over again. With wine, you have one shot a year to do it. That's why we vintage date everything. That's why we talk about vintages. It's a process that starts in March when they leaf out, and it, you know, finishes in October, November when we're done fermenting. And then it sits in, you know, if it's a Cabernet, it sits in barrels for 24 months before we pull it out to bottle it. So you have a long time to think these things over, a long time to stress about it, and a long time to mess it up if you're impatient. but it's definitely not a commodity-driven thing. It's definitely something that takes a lot of skill and patience, and you know, you really have to understand the dynamics of the audience that you're trying to make your product for, and how the style that you want to present, and those things all. They take on a very different role than the 24-hour brew cycle. It's just a completely different thing. Yeah.
So here in the tasting room, I don't know how many days a week you actually work in here, but I'm sure obviously you've met with hundreds of people over the years. What do you find one of the greater challenges when it comes to educating people, especially getting them out of the, I don't drink whites, I don't drink reds? You know, part of your job here, whether you're the winemaker or not, whether people know that or not, is to educate.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
To break down walls. What do you find as some of your bigger challenges?
I just find there's preconceived notions about things that maybe have been perpetuated, you know, even by movies like Sideways, where, you know, the classic line, I'm not drinking any, you know, Merlot, insert explicit of there. But it's I think people assume because they've maybe had 4 or 5 or maybe 10 Merlots or 10 Chardonnays that they don't like the varietal. And chances are that you just haven't had one that you like yet is more the thing. And so, if sure, there are some varietals that probably don't mesh with you, but I would suggest trying a lot more before you make up your mind on that. I've yet to find a varietal that I don't like. I've found plenty of wineries interpretation of the varietal that I don't like, but I've yet to find a varietal that I don't like. I think the other thing is, too, is it's very... I find this very intriguing, though, is just to educate people in California on the microclimates, because a lot of people that come in here, I would say 40% aren't from the area, and they just don't understand, because they're from a different area, how the fog and the coastal mountains influence how we grow things out here, and they're always just kind of blown away by it. You know, it can be 65 or 60 degrees at the ocean, and it's 11 miles inland, it could be 103, and they just, but it's, and they're like, well, that's a different day. I'm like, no, that's the same day. Yeah, it's right now.
Well, even for a lot of people, when I first started coming out here, you'd go up valley, whether it be here or the other valley, and if you were staying down in, say, the Carneros area, say, for example, if you had a swimming pool at your hotel, if you weren't in the pool by 3, forget about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it would get cooler in the afternoon.
Yeah, yeah.
And especially people from where I come from don't understand that.
Yeah.
It's usually relatively consistent.
And you can drive pretty much anywhere in the state and it would be within a few degrees of the same temperature, right? I mean, and that's very much not the case here.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very different situation. Windsor's a neat little area. And there's one thing that's funny about this general whole corridor in Sonoma is there's just a boatload of wineries.
Yes.
Which is really cool, because I would imagine from your point of view, more competition really is a good thing in this way.
It absolutely is, yeah. I think, you know, ultimately this Sonoma County, in my opinion, needs to be a destination point akin to Napa, but different, and we are different. We have embraced a much larger economy that varies a little bit more as far as, you know, farms and breweries and great restaurants and things. And it's not just about wine here. Where I find when I go to Napa, it is more just about wine. And there's no right or wrong behind any of that. It's just, it's the way it's happened. It's the difference in geography and topography between the counties. But I think Sonoma has a lot to offer, and I think part of it is wine, but part of it is a lot of other things that are really interesting too.
Beauty is one of those things, because it's completely different looking than Napa.
Completely,
And the roads are different, the layout is different.
Yeah. And you have, you have the coast here, which is, you know, a huge, huge plus for me. I love going to the coast and, the coastal redwoods that come along with it and all of the little growing regions as you get from the coast, where you start with Pinot and Chardonnay and those cooler varieties. And then as you go inland, you bump up against the Mayacamas in Napa County, and then you're in the warmer areas where we grow Cab and Merlot, and then you have everything in between, Zinfandel and, you know, Syrah and some of those Rhone varietals. So there's a great diversity in the climate and the topography as you move from west to east. And I think, you're also seeing just an incredible blow up of a microbrew scene here. That kind of the epicenter is Santa Rosa, but it's, you know, I'm sure it's happening everywhere. But pound for pound, I think this Sonoma County, this area, has one of the most charged brewing scenes around.
Different personalities here too. That's one of the big things I find in Sonoma. And Sonoma, to me, also to your background, is very Italian in many ways, which is ironic, I think.
But it is,
You drive through the countryside and you get this more feel of Italy. It's crazy.
Well, there was a huge Italian immigrant population that settled out in Sonoma County, and you can look at some of the old, when you look at some of the old winery names, you know, Sagazio and Fappiano, and you go down the list, and some of the ones that have been, you know, Sebastiani, that have been grandfathered in as, you know, they were essentially the founders of the initial wine industry. And so a lot of that influence is still in the county.
Absolutely. I know you got to open up the tasting room here in a couple of minutes. So for our listeners who'd like to learn about you online, how would they find you? What is your website?
Yes, we have a website. It's www.bfwwine.com.
So there's just not the name. Yeah. But if you probably type in the name, it should come up.
It should come up, yeah. Yeah, and particularly, I mean, Baldassare is a tough one to spell, so it's Baldassari.
Excellent. Yeah. Great. Well, Matt, thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate it. And, I wish you guys nothing but great success here.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
Learn more by visiting bfwwines.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Additional original music by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak and Catherine Shearer. Copyright 2019.